Item 1210, adopt a new comprehensive plan for the city of Portland.
Okay, and I think, Susan, is there any more introductory material you want to provide now before we start taking testimony?
Sure, I just want to speak for 2 or 3 minutes. We did have 5 work sessions, so I don't need to do a long presentation. You've gotten all the information, but I did want to provide you with a few key themes to keep in mind before we get started. You're going to hear today everything from the big picture, looking at housing and transportation and land use and jobs and the environment, all the way down to specific neighborhoods and specific properties. The details are absolutely important, but so's the big picture and the overall goals that we're trying to meet. So here's 5 themes to keep in mind. The first is to remember that what you are doing here today really does make a difference, that great places don't happen by accident. We are this great, wonderful, walkable, prosperous, beautiful place, precisely because we did a comprehensive plan 35 years ago, and that plan led us in a very different direction than most American cities. So we have great bones to build on. My second point is that this plan is not just about zoning and setbacks and urban design. This plan is about people. It's about serving people and creating great neighborhoods, a great downtown, employment opportunities, housing types of all sorts, a great transportation system, and to protect the environment for us and for future generations. My third point is about meeting the demand for housing and jobs. You all know that the demand for housing currently is outstripped. The demand for housing has outstripped supply. We need more multifamily and more single-family housing, and this plan provides a way to meet that demand, though it absolutely does not, in and of itself, solve the affordable housing crisis. In terms of jobs, we forecast 140,000 more jobs in the next 20 years, and the plan provides adequate land for all employment needs. We understand that the low marine forecast may not be good for marketing or for branding for the port, but it is accurate and it is more realistic. My fourth point is that the plan will help us meet our infrastructure needs. It lays out a plan for streets and water, stormwater, sewer, parks. It does it efficiently by maximizing the use of existing infrastructure. That means that we encourage more development that's close to existing parks and schools and transit and public facilities. And then it also plans for additional infrastructure from sidewalks to parks in East Portland and other underserved neighborhoods. Finally, my last point for you to consider is this. The proposed plan will help us create a more efficient and low-carbon economy and prepare for climate change. One thing that we know for sure is that the federal government is not moving quickly on climate change. Cities have to take the lead, and that's just what they're doing all over the world. So in summary, the proposed plan builds on the past. It will help people thrive with more and better housing, jobs, and great neighborhoods. It will help us spend limited infrastructure dollars wisely, and it will help us impact and prepare for climate change. So again, the details you're going to hear about today are super important, but try to keep, as you're listening to some of the testifiers, the bigger picture also in mind. That's it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Sure.
So I'm just a little confused because I thought somebody on the economic opportunity analysis, the growth forecast for the marine, I thought somebody said that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability had recommended the medium growth. That's
no,
not correct.
No, okay. We recommended the low forecast. Yes, and I know there's some discrepancy here, and I am absolutely sure that the best way to do this is to put the tables in front of you, either as a work session after all the testimony, or individually to let you understand the data that we have.
Yeah. Susan, one of the challenges we're going to have as we start hearing testimony is balancing the desire of some folks in our community to put very clear policy directives in the comp plan and our need to keep the comp plan consistent with what state law provides. And at what point in this process will we have a conversation about where that line is and what our role is?
So we're going to have work sessions after all of the different opportunities for hearing. And at that time, I think we should bring that up, and there is some wiggle room in there. There's not a direct line saying this is in and this is out. I think it'll be a little bit of your discretion in terms of what actual items in the comp plan do you see as land use actions and what ones aren't.
So what I would say, if we're going to do that in a comp plan, in a work session, that makes sense. My hope, my expectation would be we'd get a briefing from you and from the city attorney's office about some of the applicable principles.
Yes.
And some examples, and then some definition of where the gray is. Where do we have that wiggle room? And then some concrete examples that we can work through.
We can do that. Thanks.
Okay, great. Susan, thanks. Thank you very much. All right, let's begin with testimony, please.
I believe so far we have 70 people signed up.
We will not get to them all today.
The first three, please come on up, are 1, 2, and 3, Robert McCullough, Terry Parker, and Rebecca Mode. And they'll be followed by Zev Nicholson, Nick Sovey, and Pam Fan, number 4, 5, and 6.
You get to be first instead of last this time.
Hello, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. It's a pleasure to be back. I'll be very quick today. You have a long day ahead of you. I'm representing Southeast Uplift first, then I'm going to change hats. I didn't bring my hat, but I'll change it metaphorically and talk about East Moreland. On Thursday, we had a meeting of the 7 coalitions, the ONI directors and chairs meeting. Very extensively attended with people from all of the neighborhoods. The general sentiment was that the goal one, citizen involvement, had failed pretty miserably. Not so much for lack of meetings. We had all the meetings we could possibly attend. But where it failed was the second step of feedback and involvement. And so that sentiment was pretty much echoed by all 7 coalitions. I don't have a written statement on it because you know how hard that is to organize, but you will get one. And Paul Lesner, the world's longest-winded writer, 900 pages in his dissertation, each one brilliant, is in charge of putting that together now. So let me move to East Moreland. Basically, you know, I grew up in Chicago. I lived on the wrong side of the tracks. And at the stockyard, they had a form of public involvement. It was called animal involvement. And as an animal, you're invited to a nice party, and eventually someone says, why don't you walk through the door here, and there'll be more good food. As you walk through the door, they cut off your head, and you're thrown into a big pile to be devoured later. That's a bit of our feeling. We put in extensive testimony on an R7 application. We received the rebuttal before the testimony was delivered. That's new. The rebuttal was slightly insulting. That went over badly. When we finally had the hearing, of course, we could not speak. Our testimony was misrepresented. There was extensive lobbying by the staff to make sure that our proposal was not accepted. Every other similar neighborhood's proposal was accepted. We were singled out. We still don't know why. That's because of that problem with public involvement. There was no feedback. There was no discussion. You'll hear in more detail from Rod Merrick, who is much smarter than I am, our land use chair. And he can actually walk through the bits and pieces, and I'll leave that to him. But I do want to note, we're mad as hell. And the fact is, if people are well-prepared, skilled, amiable, helpful, attending, and we're still treated badly, you can imagine what many other people feel. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead, please, Terry.
Terry Parker, a fourth-generation Portlander from Northeast Portland, and I'm representing myself today. Over the next 20 years, the Portland metro area is estimated to grow by 400,000 people. Per figures gathered by the Portland Business Alliance, car trips are expected to increase 49%, and truck trips are expected to increase by 76%, regardless of how much transit service is added. Per the city's own studies, 72% of the households in new multi-unit developments on the east side have one or more cars. Utilizing those figures along with infill, that equates to approximately 45,000 more cars by 2040. In Chapter 3, Urban Form, under Corridors 3.45 and 3.47, the comp plan addresses accommodating growth and mobility needs for people of all ages and abilities, accommodating multimodal uses, and balancing all modes of transportation. In Chapter 4, Design and Development, under Offsite Impact 4.32 and 4.33, the plan addresses mitigation of offsite impacts to residential areas and storage areas adjacent to residential uses. In Chapter 9, Parking Management Policies 9.54 through 9.57 that seek to encourage lower car ownership and limit adequate parking for car storage in new multi-unit residential development are contradictory to accommodating multimodal uses for all people in ages and abilities. Proposing more paid on-street permit parking areas is contradictory to mitigation of off-site impacts to residential areas. Additionally, policy 9.57 places more of the financial burden for new development on existing residents and businesses when it should be paying for itself. Adequate off-street parking needs to be required when new development is adjacent to established residential neighborhoods. Policy 9.6, transportation strategy for movement of, for people movement, is simply discriminatory and needs to be legally challenged. Given the privileges and immunities clause in the Oregon Constitution, equity requires that users of the vehicle modes near the top of the list should be paying higher taxes and fees for the privilege as opposed to extorting drivers at the bottom of the list. Policy 9.66 funding ordinance funding enhances this line of financial reasoning. Finally, the aforementioned policies are adopted without, if the aforementioned policies are adopted without equitable changes, even though it may be an inconvenience, the city and city leaders must set the example and lead the way. This must include lower car ownership by eliminating entire fleet of city automobiles, many of which are primarily used for single occupancy vehicle trips and take up two floors of car storage in the First and Jefferson parking structure. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Yeah.
May I present a visual?
I'm sorry?
May I present a visual?
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. You want us to pass it around?
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Hi there, Rebecca Mode. I am opposed to my large lot in Elliott at 506 Northeast Thompson being downsized to R2.5.
I'm sorry, what is it now?
It's R2A. This zoning may be appropriate for single-family homes, but it's not appropriate for my 9,375-square-foot lot.
What's your last name again?
Mode, M-O-D-E.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This proposal is not equitable compared to the other properties on my block. I will be the only large open space not able to build to its best potential, which I believe to be a duplex to the side. My block is currently, and has been for quite some time, mixed with single-family homes, apartments, and multi-dwelling properties. It is inequitable that my property is being proposed for downzoning, and the three lots at the end of my block are not. Other properties in district have been excluded from the proposal zone change, and I wish to be as well. This is my home where I've lived and raised my family for the last 16 years. I only ask for the right to build respectfully in the future on my lot with its current zoning in a city that needs more housing. I also have questions about if there will be compensation for people who have their land devalued with the zone proposal. And if a Measure 49 claim might apply for that. Okay.
Do you know why your lot is proposed for downzoning?
I do. It's part of the Elliott Conservation District that was made 30 years ago. So it's not all of Elliott neighborhood. It's just the parts that were made the Conservation District 30 years ago. And I think the goal is, you know, so people stop building these huge things amongst the little houses in the neighborhood. And so people stop tearing down houses, which is not what I want to do. I have no desire to tear down my house. I just want to.
Is your house a historic house?
It is from 1910 duplex. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You.
You're welcome.
Thank you for raising this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next three are Zev Nicholson, Nick Sovey, and Pam Fan. That's 4, 5, and 6. And they'll be followed by Don Grotting, Frida Christopher, and Doug Klotz, 7, 8, and 9.
Dan, you're going to have some supporters here. So, yes, we'll do that. We can. I understand you're going to have a silent Greek chorus behind you here. Okay, Nick, are you on first or is someone else going to?
Zev.
Zev, all right. Hi, I'm Zev. I'm the organizing director for the Urban League of Portland. I'm here today representing ADPDX with my colleagues. We represent over 30 organizations from community to labor to faith to immigrant to people of color to middle class to lower economic status, houseless, and so forth. When we talk about displacement for the black community, the negative effects of displacement have been there for a very long time. The history cannot be untied from the realities we see today. You know, from destruction of our neighborhoods to bulldozing to just not repairing them when they get broken. These things compound over years. The Black community is one-third of Black Oregonians are house owners versus two-thirds of white Oregonians. And when we don't have a sense of community, a sense of safety, that affects every aspect of our life. For a mother, the womb is the incubator of the child. The community is the incubator of that mother. And when you don't have a sense of safety and community and support, you don't have childcare, you don't have, you're constantly stressed out, that leads to Black women being almost twice as likely to have children of low birth weight, which then puts them behind in school, which puts them behind for graduation, which puts them in prison, and so forth. And we see this whole cyclical system of oppression that leads people down. So we think this is the wrong path for Portland. And by coming together, we can change these outcomes and pass the comp plan. The time is now. Just say yes.
Thank you very much. Nick, welcome.
I'm Nick Sovey, the director of Rose Community Development. You have important decisions to make that will shape the city for decades. We need you to just say yes and adopt the anti-displacement PDX policies into the new comprehensive plan. I grew up in Portland, and I remember participating in workshops for the original comp plan. I'm a huge believer in Oregon's land use system. Smart land use planning has produced many of the things that we love about Portland: a healthy downtown, livable neighborhoods, and access to nature. The problem is we only got the original comp plan half right. We made the decisions that made many parts of Portland desirable, but we didn't make the decisions that make Portland livable for everyone. Low-income people and communities of color especially have been left out in the cold. This is what happened when we took the wrong path. Displacement of more than 10,000 people of color in North and Northeast in 10 years. Homelessness as bad as it's been in my lifetime. A city that is affordable exactly nowhere for the average Black or Native American household. East Portland, long considered the city's housing cost safety valve, is experiencing annual rent increases of 10 to 15%. We are already seeing mass displacement in East Portland, which is why the East Portland Action Plan held its own anti-displacement summit and adopted an anti-displacement strategy. The nonprofit where I work, Rose, gets hundreds of calls from people desperate for housing, but our waiting lists have been closed for months. I hope that this council recognizes that permanently affordable, nonprofit-owned, and community-controlled housing is an important solution to Portland's housing emergency. Rose is proud to be a member of Anti-Displacement PDX. I encourage you all to adopt all 28 of its recommendations to the new comp plan. Don't repeat the mistakes of the 1980s. Don't get the comp plan half right. Just say yes.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, commissioners, for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Pam Fawn. I'm with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I'm also a proud Oregonian who was born and raised in Southeast Portland. And, you know, I reflect on my time here and see kind of a lot of the changes that have happened, especially in the last 10 to 15 years, that we see a lot of the shifts that both Zev and Nick have talked about. And I think they've shown this really urgent and historic reasons for why we're really in this affordability crisis right now. We must act now, lest we go down an even more disastrous path in a future where people of color, those of low incomes, and the houseless are really segregated out of Portland completely. Is this the legacy you want this council to have? The draft plan before you is to change this course. We're really optimistic about this. Race and income disparity do not have to be the way that we define our next generation. And you simply have to vote yes. So an essential policy in the draft plan, which we worked and advocated over the last 10 months to include, was Chapter 2, Community Involvement, Goal 2B, which is titled Social Justice and Equity. It states that the city will engage communities who have experienced and been affected by these critical disparities as partners and ensuring that we don't go down this path towards segregation. So what I'm excited about these partnerships are that we can actually grow and fully invest in them to create empowered communities that are civically active in communities who have been underrepresented and haven't had a voice. But only if you say yes. Today, we're here all together, united as Portlanders. We are houseless. We are renters, people of color, those of low incomes, those of middle incomes, homeowners, advocates, all here united to urge you that displacement and gentrification, you can end displacement and make gentrification a thing of the past. You have this opportunity to do what no one has ever done in Oregon, which is to tie our forward-thinking and progressive land use system to the values, true values of livability for all. Please, just say yes.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
The next three are Don Grotting, Frida Christopher, and Doug Klotz. That's 7, 8, and 9, and they'll be followed by Bree Romago, Rodney Fleiger, and Mary Vogel, 10, 11, and 12.
Good afternoon. Why don't you go ahead, Doug, while they're getting set.
All right. I'm Doug Klotz. I am the land use chair and the Richard Neighborhood Board member, but I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm speaking for myself. I support the comp plan draft. I have some comments about it. As you know, most multifamily is being built in commercial zones right now. The mixed-use housing, the mixed-use proposal will reduce the capacity of the commercial zones, but except when a developer takes advantage of the bonuses and gets additional FAR and a partial fifth floor by providing affordable housing, among others, but mostly it's affordable housing. Unfortunately, I've discovered that this bonus is only available in inner neighborhoods. In order to take advantage of that bonus, you have to have a D overlay on the site, and that's generally only available in the urban center comp plan designation, which extends at best to 50th, and on Division it's to 44th, and Belmont's about the same. And it was taken off of Powell. So I would propose that the mixed-use urban center designation be extended along Division beyond 44th to 51st. 50th and Division has 400 units of housing being either built or planned. The bus line, there's a bus every 4 minutes during rush hour because of two bus lines there. So extending that urban center designation would allow the D overlay, which would allow that bonus to be taken advantage of on the housing in that corridor. Likewise, Southeast Powell. Now, it was originally going to be urban center, but ODOT apparently is concerned that there would be people living there, and they wanted it downgraded to Civic Corridor, which doesn't have as much capacity in it. But I would say that we need to just say that ODOT is wrong on that, and that we are developing high capacity transit on Powell. We're going to have stops at 50th and Chavez and 26th, and we need to get the housing there and get that urban center so we can get design overlay and get those bonuses. So.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you very much. Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, commissioners. First, I'm here to thank the City Council and your departments for engaging in conversations with the David Douglas School District, addressing our critical infrastructure needs relating to school capacity, housing, and other services needed in our district and our community.
Don, put your name in the record.
My name is Don Grotting, David Douglas School District Superintendent. Thank you. We've been working with Parks and Recreation, talking about cohabiting land for needed school sites. In addition, we've been talking with PDC regarding urban renewal zones and planning and sustainability regarding affordable housing and student growth. As you know, David Douglas School District consists of 12 square miles in East Portland. We have 9 elementary schools, 3 middle schools, the largest high school in the state, and we also serve all of the children birth to 5 that have special needs throughout Multnomah County. Our current enrollment is nearly 11,000 students with over 80 different languages spoken. Our school population and demographics have changed dramatically since 1996. The district's population grew from 7,000 to an estimated 11,000. This is about a 47% increase in student growth. The district went from having flexibility in our facilities to our schools now at or over capacity. Our free and reduced lunch went from 39% to now over 80%. And our ELL population has grown from 6% to 25%, with over 50% of our students having been in that program at one time or another. I provided you with an article talking about these things in the Portland Tribune, and we've just completed our facility draft plan. And Commissioner Fish, you noted we are going with the lower estimate of an estimated growth of 3,000 students. That growth could be as high as 6,000 to 8,000 students. And our immediate needs are within the next 5 to 10 years to build 2 elementary schools. After that, it's a middle school, and definitely to add to our high school. Just a final note, and once again, a congratulations. I provided you with a magazine that outlined David Douglas and the early childhood program and our second language program being selected as one of 5 sites in the nation for best programs, and that's due to your investment into early childhood. And I know the city's investment, and I know many of you up here made personal investments. So it's a kind of a silver lining, and we have more and more people wanting to come into our district. We simply don't have the capacity to house them.
Don, I have 2 questions. I know we have lots of people. But,
yeah, maybe we'll let Frieda justify.
We're kind of carrying over our 2 minutes to 4.
Okay. She may answer some of your questions.
Let Frieda speak, and then I think we're going to have a number of questions for you because this is a pretty important coordination issue here.
So. Okay. My name is Frieda Crisper. I'm a member of the David O. School Board for 24 years, so I've seen all this change over the years. But today, we especially would like to thank the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the Commission for their cooperative approach and in recognizing how population growth can impact school capacity and our district's goals to provide the most, the highest quality education opportunities for our students now and in the future, no matter whether they come from low income or high income. In the draft plan, you have goal number 8K, which is school facilities. It states, public schools are honored places of learning, as well as multifunction neighborhoods anchors, serving Portlanders of all ages, ability, and cultures. Don mentioned our early childhood program, which is at Earl Boyle's. It has a community hub. We are a demonstration of how this goal works. And it's a very successful demonstration. In with our capacity issues, there's 2 policies that the Commission and Planning Sustainability have put in. Policy 8.108, School District Capacity, which is the consideration of overall enrollment capacity in a school district as a factor in land use decisions that increase capacity for residential development, and in policy 5.23, the impact of housing on schools. It states, evaluate plans and investments for the effect of housing development on school districts to ensure plans are aligned with school facility plans. This is good policy, not for just David Douglas, but for all the schools in Portland. As representative of the David Douglas Administration and School Board, we would like the draft language in regard to the above-mentioned policies to remain a final part of this plan. It is important that schools are now considered. We are a service. We provide service to all the children within this city, and it's an important service, and we need to be considered where growth happens. Thank you.
So, Commissioner Fish, you've got some questions. I do, too.
After you.
Okay. So, I really appreciate you being here and appreciate the compliments for the process so far, but I guess I have a couple of concerns, and they sort of go in both directions. One, I'm a little concerned that you're taking your low forecast for student growth, enrollment growth. I'm more comfortable with taking a low forecast to the need for industrial land because we can use industrial land more efficiently, and we're proving that in the Central East Side and elsewhere as we speak. But I'm concerned about that, so I guess I'd like to hear you illuminate that a little further. And then this isn't directed in particular at David Douglas, but actually you're part of this pattern as well, and that is for a while we built schools as very compact, dense facilities like Washington High School and Grant. And then we built them, starting when I was in elementary school, in a 1950s and 60s industrial model where they're generally two stories tall and they occupy a great deal of land. An extreme example of that is we have a school of that model 10 blocks west of here, or at Lincoln High School, in some of the most expensive land in the state, that's two stories tall and built in the industrial model. I visited a school in Taiwan, which is the most prestigious school in the city that you visited, and last I checked there were 4,000 students on about 5 acres. So where are we going with respect to school facility design? And it seems to me if we're still headed off on the 1960s vision of 10-acre sites and two-story buildings, and you're wrong on your forecast, we're in big trouble. So help me out there.
Great comments, Mayor. Anything that David Douglas builds in the future will be in multiple stories. We simply, there is not the land parcels out there. Just for your information, it takes about 6 to 8 acres to build a elementary school and somewhere between 10 to 12 acres to build a middle school. And that's really not, depending on ball fields and parking, that's really going up fairly high. The reason that we went with the lower growth in order to build two elementary schools and just to address some general maintenance needs, we're talking about $120 million bond, and most of the residents of our district are either low income, we have an elderly on fixed income, and we're just trying to weigh what can our citizens support as far as a tax measure. And as you know, David Douglas is one of the has the least ability to increase taxes per their constituents because of the low tax base. Basically, we have very little industrial commercial entities within our district.
I'd like to tag on to that because I was part in some of the facility meetings. David Douglas has a history of looking outside the box. That's why we have the Earl Boyle demonstration site. We were the leaders in Sim and Cam when it was going. And we're not tied to the old model because we realize we have a lack of space. We're looking at multiple ways of how we might have to build, how we might have convert a middle school to a high school. We're just looking at any possibility. We may have to look at, try to figure out what is an urban school, a true, true urban school, because we are only 12 square miles and we don't have a lot of land available.
Some of the things we've talked about is even maybe you don't have need to have your fields or space there. Maybe is there something we can cohabit with the parks and recreation to maybe this is just the school and a very small space there for students and do our recreation somewhere else in a combined effort to make it work.
So I have, Don, congratulations to both of you on the success of Earl Boyle's. And I have two requests for information following this hearing. We have lots of people waiting, so I want to just
Yes.
put the requests out there. The first is data on, in the elementary school classes, what percentage of the kids who start on day one finish each year. And I was at a school in Centennial recently where, in part because of unstable housing in the community, 50% of the children who started on day one did not finish that school year. And so if we want to put the housing crisis in stark relief, that's about as compelling a statistic as I can think of. The second is we're about to go into our budget. We're going actually entering into our budget process. And one of the concerns that I have is that with land prices inflating very quickly, even in places like David Douglas, with particularly out-of-state investment companies coming in, if we don't land bank now, we're going to lose opportunities. And, you know, you've got Habitat, you've got lots of other partners that have had some success in East Portland. I want to make sure that that the tools that the city has, particularly through the Housing Bureau, are flexible enough to help Habitat and other trusted partners acquire dirt now and land bank if necessary, so that we can be thinking about building quality housing that's adjacent to schools. And if we don't, then 5.23 is going to become just an aspiration on a piece of paper with the opportunity having eluded us. So if we could follow up on both.
I will get you that information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for what you do.
Thanks, same to you.
You make me feel good every time I think I have problems.
Yeah, well, I was in one of your middle schools lately, and I think being a middle school teacher is tougher than this. So.
The next three are 10, 11, and 12, Bree Romago, Rodney Fleiger, and Mary Vogel, and they'll be followed by Mary Coolidge, Carol McCarthy, and Jan Mawson, 13, 14, and 15.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Mayor Hales, Commissioners, I am Bree Romago, here on behalf of the Brummel family and our businesses. My grandparents started them approximately 50 years ago in the Selwood area. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our mixed use and comprehensive plan comments. Today, we own and operate over 60 residential and commercial properties, primarily in the Selwood neighborhood. Our desire is to grow over the long term, but in a way that takes into consideration the needs of the community, while also understanding that Portland is a vibrant city with growing housing concerns. We are fortunate to have Rodney Fleiger working with us to accomplish these goals. He is an employee of Brummel Enterprises and is active in both the Selwood Moreland Improvement League, SMILE, and Selwood Westmoreland Business Alliance, SWBA. He will complete our testimony on behalf of Brummel Enterprises. We recently provided written documents to the council, and I have copies of those with me if anyone's interested in them, having them today in front of you. The written testimony more completely outlines the properties where we are asking for updated designations and zoning and our reasons for making the requests. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, if you would leave those with our clerk, that'd
Absolutely.
Be helpful, because I think we've gotten a lot of correspondence. It's nice to have it when the person's here. So.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Rodney Fleiger. During the past 2 years, we have participated and listened to the interests of the SMILE organization and the Selwood and Moreland community. I'm commencing my second year on the SWBA Selwood Westmoreland Business Alliance as a board member, and I sit on the Land Use Committee. We've observed the SMILE interests and new developments in the area of concern to them in a recent survey that was conducted, as well as our monthly meetings expressed, affordable housing and affordable commercial space, common area plazas, building curb appeal and setbacks, as well as parking. We met with a SMILE recently, the Land Use Committee, and discussed the packet that Bree has turned into the clerk, and we plan on having a second workshop with the Land Use Committee December 4th. We are in communication with the community, and we are reaching out to the Brooklyn community, which also we have two parcels in that community council area. Spending time this past year observing and participating with the comprehensive plan process, we see a rare opportunity for the Selwood-Moreland area, as well as us as property owners, to be more creative and flexible, developing amenities in our community. And we would like to thank the Bureau for their work and the personnel within the Bureau this past year during this process and output and intake from the community, and think that they've done a good job with their public hearings. We realize that your efforts now commence and urge you to consider our comments and the packet that we've submitted. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm Mary Vogel. I'm a resident of the west end of the downtown neighborhood. And I'm also active in the Neighborhood Association, but I'm speaking for myself and my small business Plan Green planning consultancy today. First, I want to say I applaud the plan draft and its goals and policies, and I'm especially speaking to the following ones today that I particularly like, In Chapter 3, Urban Forum, a climate and hazard resilient urban forum, energy and resource efficiency, integrate nature, green infrastructure in centers. In Chapter 4, Design and Development, noise impacts and air quality impacts, encourage building and landscape design and land use patterns that limit and or mitigate negative noise impacts to building users and residents, particularly in areas near freeways, regional truckways, major cities, traffic streets, and other sources of noise and air pollution. And much of Chapter 7 on watershed health as well, but I'm not going to go there today. However, these points, the ones I mentioned above, got very little attention in the West Quadrant Plan. In light of the Ombudsman's report finding described in the Northwest Examiner here, I ask that the approval process for the West Quadrant Plan part of the comp plan be stopped until the document can be reviewed by a new, more balanced, conflict of interest-free strategic advisory committee. As a downtown resident, I tried to get attention of the previous strategic advisory committee regarding the need for more street trees and other green infrastructure strategies in front of the residences and businesses that were closest to I-405 without success. I want to call out these investors and landlords as needing to be involved in the early steps of your implementation timeline for downtown, by the way. John Niemeyer of Gladstone, Oregon, Stephen Blindheim of the West Hills, and James Major of Northeast Portland. They are property owners of buildings with no trees in blocks that are within a block of I-405 in the west end of downtown.
Thank you for your testimony, Mary. I'm afraid we forgot to put the timer on, but I think you've had about 2 minutes.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
The timer wasn't going, but I believe that you've had about 2 minutes. So, if you'd,
oh. So just wrap up, if you would, please.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to say that even when offered free street trees by the Bureau of Environmental Services, they... And that's about a $3,400 gift per tree because it will include concrete removal. These owners have apparently not been forthcoming even to accept a free street trees at their property. So I'd like to see the, I know this is a 20-year plan aimed at shaping new development, but I want to see some teeth added to the comp plan that would affect current property owners and give them a greater push to help neighborhoods, including mine, fulfill some of the excellent goals and policies of the plan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. And do you have copies, Carla, of the Rummel's submittal for us?
Next three are Mary Coolidge, Carol McCarthy, and Jan Mawson. 13, 14, and 15, and they'll be followed by Jean-Claude Paris, Simeon Hyde, and I believe it's Javier, maybe Peters, on Loma Boulevard. That's 16, 17, and 18.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi there. My name is Mary Coolidge. I'm with Audubon Society of Portland as the BirdSafe Portland campaign coordinator. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for the opportunity to testify today. The incorporation of green infrastructure into the 2035 Comprehensive Plan demonstrates Portland's commitment to develop our built landscape in an ecologically thoughtful way over the next 20 years. At a time when urban land areas are expanding rapidly, it's more important than ever that we maintain the ecological integrity of the built environment. The recent integration of bird-safe building design, responsible lighting design, and eco-roofs into the city's updated green building policy emphasizes the importance of both ecological and human health in a new phase of innovative green design. We also need to be thinking broadly about what should be included as we define approaches to integrating nature into our built landscape. We recommend that policies related to integration of nature into the built environment in Chapter 7 of the Comp Plan and designing with nature in Chapter 4 provides specific direction about avoiding the proliferation of blue-rich white light in both public and private development. Blue-rich white light LEDs, like the ones we are currently installing on our city streets, are overly bright, create significant glare, scatter more readily than long wavelength light sources, and emit harmful blue light into the nighttime environment. Light which has been demonstrated to impact circadian rhythms in humans, plants, fish, and wildlife. While we applaud the Climate Action Plan and City Council's efforts to increase energy efficiency, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and to install fixtures that direct light only down, we encourage the City Council to direct Bureau efforts to research the best available science on the ecological and human health impacts of blue-rich white lighting. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Welcome. Thank you. We'll get back to you on that. I and PBOT staff will talk to you about that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Carol McCarthy, and I'm testifying today as the chair of the Multnomah Neighborhood Association. Our members have submitted over 400 letters to you requesting three changes that we think are critical to maintaining Multnomah as the vibrant place that it is. These three requests are consistent with positions adopted by the Neighborhood Association and endorsed by the Sweeney Board. The first request is that you designate Multnomah Village as a neighborhood corridor rather than as a neighborhood center. We are requesting this to preserve our neighborhood's character. The sentiment that the village needs protection was expressed by people from all over Portland and the U.S., and in fact from around the world, in the almost 700 written comments submitted as part of the attached online petition that was signed by over 1,800 people. The second and related request is that you limit building heights in the village to three stories. We would like you to zone the village CM1 with a 35-foot building height limit. Buildings higher than three stories will dwarf the existing historic buildings, most of which are one or two stories high. Capitol Highway through the village is a very narrow street. Four-story buildings would make it feel more like a canyon than the comfortable place it is now to take a stroll, look in the shops, get something to eat, watch the sunset, or just look at the sky. Please require that future development be in scale with this place that we love. Our third request is for truth in zoning. We would like the zoning map to define lot sizes so that, for example, if a person buys a house in an area zoned R5, their expectation that their neighbor's lots would not be divided into lots smaller than 5,000 square feet would be met. Specifically, we are requesting that the sentence in my handout be removed. As part of this request, the zoning code would need to be amended to require that cornered lot sizes be consistent with the maximum general density stated in the plan. Thank you.
Not sure if I understand your last point. Not sure if I understand your last point well, which is the language being removed isn't talking about lot size. It's talking about the existing, I think it's talking about the existing allowance for duplexes on R5 corner lots.
Right.
And accessory dwelling units. So those are allowed uses, not smaller lots. So I'm not sure if I'm tracking your recommendation.
Right. So it's our feeling that the general use and intensity expected within an area should be defined in the zone, so that if it's R5, it's a 5,000 square foot lot. And we see this very specific language as support of the policy that's in the code in the zoning code that allows the corner lot splitting.
Okay, all right, I think I understand. But you're suggesting this be changed citywide.
That's right. But and also because it's so specific, and we think that as an example of something that would be allowed, it's too specific for the comp plan. We would rather that the general use and intensity be reflected in the zone, not in exceptions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Mawson, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. I was privileged to work at the Oregon Historical Society under Thomas Vaughn, who was a pioneer in historic preservation in Oregon. My concern is the lack of protections in the plan for Portland's older neighborhoods, many of which do not have official landmark status. I live in Multnomah Village, which is classified as a neighborhood center, as we've heard. This designation fails to recognize the unique historic character of the village by encouraging the introduction of 4 to 5 story mixed-use buildings that are out of scale with the existing Main Street and surrounding residential area. The end result will be the loss of Multnomah Village as it currently exists, including its vital sense of place and community. A more appropriate classification would be neighborhood corridor, which would result in less intense development and greater protections for thriving businesses and older, sought-after single-family homes, many of which combine aesthetic appeal with affordability. In a 1978 report prepared by the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission and the Portland Bureau of Planning, titled An Inventory of Historic Resources, Potential Historic Conservation Districts, the author Alfred Staley notes, Multnomah's unique history and architecture make it worthy of saving. I don't have time to read my summary paragraph now, but I have included his entire report about Multnomah Village in my packet. This opinion is shared by the Multnomah Neighborhood Association, representing a majority of residents who have spoken out in favor of integrating development without sacrificing the quaint appeal of the village in the heart of Portland, which is our claim to fame. And I heard your planner talk about building on the past, not destroying the past. I am asking that you change the designation of Multnomah Village in the plan before you from neighborhood center to neighborhood corridor with an absolute design overlay, excluding community design standards, which have not worked and which exclude the voice of the neighborhood.
Thank you very much.
The next three are John Claude Paris, Simeon Hyde, and the last name is Peterson on Multnomah Boulevard. That's 16, 17, and 18. And they'll be followed by Donna Beswick, Alan Kirkland, and Bernadine Bond, 19, 20, and 21.
Order bus down.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Mr. Mayor, City Council. My name is Jean-Claude Paris, a resident of Multnomah Village. I'm a retired international banker, founder of the French-American International School and the Alliance Française in Portland, a former honorary French consul for the state of Oregon. I'm testifying today about historical neighborhoods within large cities. In Europe, in every city larger than Portland, politicians and city councils have retained small villages within or close to financial and business centers. These villages are protected by classifying them as historical treasures. Any extension in height, density are limited, restricting and protecting architectural design style. Examples are Montmartre in Paris, the old city of Nice and Avignon, the city of Carcassonne, just to name a few. In America, a number of very large cities have well-known and unique villages nearby, again, their financial district. As well, such as North Beach in San Francisco, Greenwich Village in New York City, the French Quarter in New Orleans, and so on. When the city talks about density, about necessary density, this already exists and is going to continue growing. Within Multnomah Village, many little bungalows are coming down and replaced by 2, 3, or 4 new mega-size overpowering dwellings. It is going to be a nightmare to add more density in the core of the village where more density is happening every day. Let's keep and preserve our unique Portland neighborhoods and keep Multnomah the sole village in the heart of the city. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome. Good afternoon.
My name is Simeon Hyde, and I live in a house in Multnomah Village.
I appear before you today to talk about developmental impacts on our communities. Careful and thorough planning lies at the core of successful developments. An important part of the development process is the willingness of developers and neighbors to listen to each other and reach compromises. I propose the following impact studies be conducted and the results be the basis for development decisions reached: traffic, parking, public transit, public infrastructure. Even though these four proposed study areas may already be required, the question arises as to how they were conducted and if their results were utilized in the development process. Another area of concern for me and many others is the question of building heights and massing. The actual design of new buildings directly impacts neighborhood livability. On North Mississippi Avenue, I've seen firsthand the negative impact of four-story buildings built immediately next to single-floor bungalow-style homes. While tending gardens or enjoying the play of their children in their backyards, these homeowners report an almost palpable sense of being watched from the four floors of windows in the building just constructed right next door. I can only guess at the negative impact and the resale value of these homes. I propose the following areas receive priority when city planners consider the issue of building heights and massing: visual privacy for neighboring homes and backyards, retaining existing sight lines and views for neighboring properties, solar orientation and access for neighbors, impact on neighboring property values. As regards a comprehensive plan as it is now written, I feel it is seriously flawed. The proposed draft is written and presented in such a way that it's difficult to understand. Many citizens feel there was inadequate citizen involvement throughout the planning and drafting process. Multnomah Village has a thriving business district along with neighboring homes, many of which show distinctive architectural features. In conclusion, the old phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, seems to apply here. We are the taxpayers, in a very real sense, the custodians of our neighborhood. It is only just that we get to have a strong voice in the future of our village.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is James Peterson. I'm the land use chair of Multnomah Neighborhood Association. I want to bring your attention to some process problems on how we were told in the beginning that there was a neighborhood center, which was defined in the current plan with a misprint, a half-mile radius, and a 3,500 housing units. Then all of a sudden, without any in the staff report to the Planning Commission, provisional boundaries were then determined without any public input and no direct policies. And they then ended up showing on these current maps that are in your document. Now, I requested on what you've had copies the last 6 months on where these policies and what testimony affected these decisions on where these boundaries came from. And I've had no direct information come forward. This is a major goal one problem. This process to determine boundaries of neighborhood centers should have gone through a public process. The second thing, the testimony that was submitted to the Planning Commission is not put into a database. I'm not sure what you're going to do with the testimony you've heard today. Is the staff really putting this into a database for you and to know which policy needs to be changed? That's my question. What happens to our testimony today?
That we are doing that, actually. I specifically requested that, so the staff is preparing a matrix of testimony that we hear at the hearings.
Okay, then why didn't that exist for the Planning Commission?
I don't know that it did or didn't, but it will hear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, just so you know, we ask that you do this or this, depending on whether you like the testimony or not.
That
way we can just keep hearing
outset,
as many people as possible.
It helps to not include a pause just because it takes time. Okay, speaking of time, let's hear the next three folks. Thank you very much.
Next three are Donna Bestwick, Alan Kirkland, and Bernadine Vaughn. That's 19, 20, and 21. And they'll be followed by Stuart Rounds, Allison Reynolds, and Chris Eichamp, 22, 23, and 24.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, I'm Donna Bestwick, and I've lived in Multnomah Village for 30 years. I moved there because of the charm, quaintness, and character of the village within a city. Most importantly, the house was affordable. I live in a small 950-square-foot home, but on a moderate salary, I was able to afford my home. We here in the yellow shirts represent 3,600 homes with 7,900 people who have lived in the village for anywhere from 1 to 40-plus years. We're primarily moderate-income families living in these affordable homes, and we have dutifully paid our property taxes every year to the city. We now find ourselves in a position of having the future livability of our village threatened by upscaling and hunger.